May it please the court, David Goodhand for the United States. With the court's permission, I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, the district court erred in granting the defendant's suppression motions below. There are three independent grounds for reversal of the district court order. Number one, the NIT warrant, the Network Investigative Technique warrant, was authorized by Rule 41b-4 in contravention of the district court's conclusion. Number two, even if this court disagrees with the conclusion that it was authorized by Rule 41b-4, it was at most a non-fundamental, as this court has used the term, non-fundamental, non-constitutional violation, which should not lead to suppression. Number three, the final independent ground for reversal, even if this court concludes it was not authorized by Rule 41b-4 and that it was somehow a fundamental violation, the third independent ground for reversal is the Leon good faith exception. The FBI agents were acting in objectively reasonable good faith reliance on a warrant issued by Magistrate Judge Buchanan out of the Eastern District of Virginia.
Counsel, how can it be on its face authorized by Rule 41 when it's authorizing a warrant outside of the magistrate's jurisdiction?
Your Honor, it's we believe, a tracking device warrant. So to the extent—
It's not the same as a tracking device. A tracking device starts in the jurisdiction and leaves.
That's the conclusion of a number of district court judges, 12 by the government's count, is that there was installation. It's really just a more sophisticated means of gathering location information. So we're a little beyond the beeper on the canister of chloroform now that was the issue in Caro. What we are doing is here a sophisticated technique for identifying location. And according to the affidavit that was supplied by the agent to Magistrate Judge Buchanan, when the users, the activating computers, accessed the government-controlled server in Virginia, the NIT was deployed at that point. It augmented the content that was sent back to their computers throughout the country. So in a way, this is very much akin, I would suggest, to defendants. It's like a sting operation that the FBI set up in Virginia. Defendants went into Virginia looking for contraband, i.e. child pornography. Attached to that contraband, the child pornography, on the government server in the Eastern District of Virginia were the computer instructions, the NIT. The defendants then took that contraband out of the Eastern District of Virginia back to their computers, and with the beeper, if you will, the NIT, which sent back identifying location information to the government-controlled server in Virginia. So, as
how also can it meet Rule 41 when it's as broad as whoever, wherever? How does that meet a particularity requirement?
Your Honor, the affidavit very carefully outlined that there were many potential users of the Playpen website, the website dedicated to child pornography. But what the affidavit very carefully outlined was that no one could innocently stumble upon that website. And what the affidavit did is it explained people could only access that website by first downloading what is called the Tor Hidden Services Network. So they downloaded Tor. Then you can't just look up the URL for this website on, you know, Google or anything like that. You have to find that particular website URL. Then you have to use your Tor network service. So there were a number of affirmative steps that a person first had to take before they—
Is there anything illegal about Tor?
Nothing. Absolutely not. In fact, I think it was first designed by the government. But the problem with Tor, of course, is that it now permits exactly what happened here. Users accessing the contraband of the child pornography can make themselves completely anonymous. So in this context, what the government did, the FBI came up with a sophisticated beeper system, a sophisticated tracking device, and they installed that on the content, the contraband that the users were accessing on the government-controlled server. Getting back to Your Honor's particularity question, while that might mean that many people would be caught in this sting operation because many people, as the affidavit explains, were accessing that child pornography on that website, the fact that there were many people who the government had probable cause to believe were engaging in criminal conduct does not defeat particularity. The particularity question is really about, were the computers specifically identified and was this, the information to be seized particularly identified? And it was. Attachment B identifies the 7 pieces of information, including the IP address, that the NIT would secure from the user's computer. That's the information to be seized, attachment B. Attachment A identified with significant particularity the activating computers who would be subject to the NIT. It had to be a person who logged on using using his password and a username. 22 district courts have considered the particularity issue. None have concluded that there was anything wrong in terms of particularity with respect to the NIT and the warrant that was provided to the magistrate judge. In that respect, I would suggest it's understandable why the defendants didn't even raise this below. I know they've proffered it now on appeal, but 22 district court judges, by the government's count, have concluded that there was nothing wrong in terms of particularity with respect to this warrant.
I have a question, counsel. This tracking device argument, I think I understand that it's made really in the sense of arguing that this is a tracking device by analogy. It's the same. It's very similar. It has a lot of similarities. And what strikes me about, as I read through all of this, this requires some pretty sophisticated knowledge about computers, about the internet, about the technology, about the science involved. Is the court, and was the court here, left to its own devices to understand all of that information, or was there some expert testimony provided in some form to educate the court and that perhaps could educate this court with respect to these matters, or are we just left to our own devices to research this independently and to educate ourselves as to how all of this works?
Sure. I think if you look in particular, this was a lengthy affidavit provided by the FBI. The beginning of the affidavit provides a glossary of terms, and it defines how the systems operate. I would suggest that glossary of terms, coupled with the careful language used by the FBI agent in the affidavit, which you don't see in every single affidavit. I mean, the FBI fully understood that they were embarking upon a sophisticated technique here. And I think when you look at that affidavit, 31 pages, and particularly the first 15 pages, detail in pretty significant detail the operation of the NIT, what an IP address is, what a service provider is, all that material. So in that respect, I think Magistrate Judge Buchanan had a lot to go on in terms of assessing whether or not this fit within the confines of Rule 41.
All that information is coming from government law enforcement.
I'm sorry, is from government law?
All of that information is coming from government law enforcement. Correct?
Of course.
Was there any other kind of expert testimony provided in this particular proceeding?
No.
As the parties were making their arguments about this technology?
No. And I do know in other cases there has been, for example, I know that Agent McFarlane was the FBI agent who swore out the affidavit here. I know that he has testified in a couple cases throughout the country. So I know that some of that testimony has been provided. But going to Your Honor's sophisticated technology point, again, we think the affidavit covered the landscape here and provided enough information for Magistrate Judge Buchanan. But the sophistication that, Your Honor points out is a fair point. And it accords with what I think this court has said in Falls, United States versus Falls, when this court is analyzing the issue of Rule 41 authorization. What this court said in United States versus Falls is you have to be careful about rigid adherence to the letter of the rule because of technological advances. And
that's why rules can be amended and should be amended to keep
absolutely
up. But
absolutely.
Until they are, it's not the court's responsibility to reinterpret them.
Well, that amendment process can take some time. For example, in this context, it took almost 3 years to get the new B6 added. I understand. I read New York Telephone Company from the Supreme Court and Falls from this court to stand for the proposition that, law enforcement doesn't have to sit on its hands in that interstitial period when the rules makers are coming up to speed with technological advances. That's my reading of Falls and New York Telephone Company. Both of those cases involved, in Falls, it was video surveillance. And the definition of property most clearly did not involve intangible property at that point. But Falls authorized, pursuant to Rule 41, the seizure of silent video surveillance, electronic intrusions in a constitutionally protected space because Falls said, we have to account for the flexibility of the rule and the technological advances that lead us to ultimately amendments eventually. But again, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I was just going to ask, in view of the fact that B6 has been added, doesn't that indicate that this kind of thing is not a tracking device under B4? Why was there a need for B6 if it's already included or permitted under the other subsection?
The government's take on B6 is that it was the ultimate clarification. So that while there was inherent in the rule the authority that the FBI agents had for this tracking device, what B6 now does is clarify that authority always existed. But of course, that's the addition of B6 answers the question in many respects from the government's perspective, the good faith question, which if I might transition to that, even if this court disagrees with the 12 district courts who have concluded that this was authorized under a federal rule of criminal procedure 41B4, it is difficult from the government's perspective to disagree with the notion that the agents were acting in objective good faith reliance on the warrant that was issued by Magistrate Judge Buchanan. The amendment, I would suggest, to Federal Rule 41B indicates that the rules makers had no problem with this type of device. Everyone agrees, both the defendants and the government, that if B6 had been in existence at the time the affidavit was filed with Magistrate Buchanan, we wouldn't be standing here. So what that suggests to the government's mind is that everyone agrees it's perfectly permissible and reasonable for the government to do this type of activity, that is, use the network investigative technique to glean via remote access location identifying information. The other feature of B6 that I think adds immeasurably to the good faith analysis is this court has to ask the question, what are we deterring? Leon and all of the court's cases from Leon forward have emphasized repeatedly the bottom line question with respect to the exclusionary rule is, what are you deterring in terms of police conduct? Well, if this court were to affirm the district court's suppression order, you wouldn't be deterring anything with respect to police conduct. First of all, it was the magistrate's error, if there was any error. The magistrate, she misunderstood her authority pursuant to Rule 41. But number two, from here on out, police officers, FBI agents, law enforcement have the authority pursuant to B6. So they're not going to be trying to do anything with respect to B4, for example. They're just going to go to B6. So there would be no deterrent value.
Can good faith apply if the warrant is void?
Yes. I have 4 points with respect to this sort of lurking void ab initio point. Number one, it, to the government's mind, runs right into the teeth of the court's exclusionary rule jurisprudence. What the exclusionary rule jurisprudence teaches is that in every single instance of a violation, there is a separate inquiry, a separate independent inquiry about the balancing, deterrence versus social costs. I do not read the Supreme Court's case to suggest that there is any exception for any sort of void ab initio warrant. And I would suggest the court's decision in Illinois v. Kroll is exactly analogous to what's going on here. There, the officers were acting pursuant to a statute. The statute was declared unconstitutional. The court nonetheless said those officers were acting in objectively reasonable good faith reliance on that statute, even though, just like the defendants are arguing here with respect to our warrant, we can all assume that the legislature never had the authority to issue an unconstitutional statute. That's point number one. It flies in the teeth of the purpose of the exclusionary rule and the independence of the exclusionary rule's application from the violation. Number two, if you look at the roots of this void ab initio point, and I think this is critical, this emanates from a district court decision called Levin out of the Massachusetts District Court. Levin itself concedes that there is no appellate court authority or Supreme Court authority to support its position. What Levin did is it looked at a Sixth Circuit decision called Scott. Levin conceded in its opinion that Scott had been, quote, effectively reversed by a subsequent Sixth Circuit decision called Master. But nonetheless, Levin, I think in somewhat astonishing fashion, said, I nonetheless am adopting the analysis of Scott and basically declaring that Master was wrongly decided. That's my second point with respect to this void ab initio concept. My third point is that it defies common sense. When you are considering objective good faith reliance and the Leon good faith exception, it seems very odd and incongruous to accept the notion that a warrant without probable cause could nonetheless not lead to suppression. On the one hand, probable cause in the Constitution, but on the other hand, a Rule 41 violation, federal rules of criminal procedure not in the Constitution, could lead to suppression. That seems very inconsistent and, again, defies common sense. That's my third point.
But don't we have precedent here in the Eighth Circuit that if a Rule 41 violation produces prejudice to the defendant, that it is that the fruits of that are excludable?
Absolutely. And that's our second argument. I was addressing the third argument relating to the application of Leon good faith. I don't think anyone disagrees that even if this court concludes that there was a Rule 41 violation and that it prejudiced the defendants, you still can apply the Leon good faith exception. My fourth point with respect to the void ab initio concept is I just want to make it quickly because I don't want to run into my rebuttal time and I see I'm coming up. The void ab initio point emanates and originates with a Judge Gorsuch concurrence in a case called United States versus Kruger. Judge Gorsuch was the first one to adopt and promote this notion that a warrant that is issued outside the authority of a magistrate could be essentially a null and void warrant. But even Judge Gorsuch, in his concurring opinion at the end of that, you will see, he says, even if you conclude that a warrant is null and void, you still engage in the exclusionary rule analysis. I'm into my rebuttal time. I will pause here. We would ask that this court reverse the district court suppression rulings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Goodhand. Mr. Dornan.
May it please the court, counsel, Stu Dornan on behalf of Mr. Horton, who's the appellee in this case. I don't often, as a criminal defense practitioner, get to argue in favor of a motion that was granted in my favor. And the standard of review, of course, is whether the judge had a record that was reliable, whether there was no erroneous application of the law, and whether or not the judge, whether or not this court finds that there was a definitive and clear mistake.
Counsel, can you speak up just a little bit?
Yes. So,
and raise that podium. There's a button there just to your right. guess it's not going on.
I'll get a little closer.
There you go.
So this court then has a very well-reasoned decision by Judge Pratt, and I want to get to a couple of the questions that the court asked of opposing counsel with respect to the reasoning of Judge Pratt's opinion. First of all, this has to do with the judicial authority, and the rule does not allow the magistrate judge to issue a warrant that tracks movable persons or objects outside of their jurisdiction. If the court doesn't have the authority to do so, then the warrant is not just voidable, it's void. And if you have a void warrant, then all of the exceptions that the government is arguing are not applicable. You have a situation here, and I think the with respect to
Brent, are you saying that the magistrate has no authority to initiate tracking within the magistrate's jurisdiction that goes outside of the district? Or are you making a distinction as to where the tracking actually begins?
The distinction, she does have the authority, if this was a tracking device, if it was originally in the jurisdiction, to move outside. I think the brief of the amicus is helpful with respect to this issue, because what you have here is a malware, which is basically a Trojan horse, if you will. And the malware is a computer code that attaches itself, makes entry into the computer where the computer is located, and that's outside the district here. After it makes entry into the computer outside of the district, it then performs a search of the items that are on that computer outside the district. It then, as a result of that search, seizes the private information that is on that computer. So you have a situation here where the device is operating outside and is deployed and installed outside of the district. A typical...
Are IP addresses considered private information?
If they are not communicated to a third party. I think Judge Pratt in his decision said that if Mr. Horton had put his IP address on a piece of paper and stuck it in his drawer, that would be a constitutionally protected area with respect to privacy. The IP addresses only become non-protected if they are transmitted to a third party, and typically in these sorts of cases to the internet service provider. So you have the internet protocol address along with a lot of other information on that computer that, as in the Riley case, you can have the most private things in your life and in your everyday living on that computer. So when you have a Trojan horse that goes into and attaches itself and is deployed, just like the individual from Fort Benning isn't deployed until he actually reaches his destination. So you have a situation where this particular device didn't operate and didn't foil it exploited a vulnerability in the activating computer. So
does it matter that the device, the NIT, as it's been referred to, isn't installed unless a user actually interface with the site that the government had seized?
Well, I guess, you know, when a user goes to the site, that user doesn't necessarily, by logging on there, become involved in chat rooms or become involved in using and accessing pornography. So you have the The first illegality with respect to the judge not having the authority to issue the warrant, I think you have to put that first. Because when you have that lack of authority, then anything that happens thereafter, in my opinion, can't overcome that initial illegality. You know, FBI agents and the Department of Justice attorneys, you know, they didn't just fall off the turnip truck with respect to the information and the installation and the request for this. Agents this is a veteran agent, 19 years. FBI recruits at law schools because they want people who have a knowledge of the law. You have an assistant attorney general who sent a letter to the Federal Rules Committee saying that there were serious difficulties. This presented serious difficulties with respect to the government doing what it wanted to do. So you have knowledge. You have the knowledge of not only the agent coming from the Levin case and just from a view of the article of 41, but you also now have the Department of Justice, which is part of this whole process, creating a clarification. This was a new subsection, but asking that this rule be changed. When you have that sort of knowledge, then you certainly at least have a recognition by the Department of Justice that there is at least an ambiguity with respect to this, and it has to be fixed. And clearly, I think, as Judge Shepard said, this is not an issue of the court changing. This court is not in a position where it needs to rewrite the law. This is an issue that Congress needed to change the law. And in some respects, the government was a day early and a dollar short because they knew that they didn't have the authority to do this. And they certainly were a day late with respect to not waiting for this clarification to be made with respect to this matter. I think I'm about where I need to be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dorner. Mr. Hansen.
Good morning. Brad Hansen for Appellee Bo Krogan. My intention here today is to focus on the Fourth Amendment particularity issue, but of course I can address any of the other issues presented to the extent there's time or questions from the court. The NIT warrant at issue in this case is truly unprecedented in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. If this court were to affirm the validity of the NIT warrant, it could very well be affirming the validity of the least particularized warrant ever dealt with in Fourth Amendment case law. And I can say that because the NIT warrant authorized the search of all activating computers, wherever located, that accessed a particular website with 150,000 users. The NIT warrant authorized the search of unknown computers owned by unknown persons located in unknown locations throughout the United States and indeed the world.
Mr. Hansen, isn't that kind of what a wiretap does? If you authorize a wiretap on somebody's phone, then anybody they talk to anywhere is subject to interception.
A roving wiretap is certainly what I would call a non-traditional, requires a non-traditional type of search warrant. The distinction here is that whereas a roving wiretap is not necessarily tied to a specific place, it's tied to a specific person or persons. Whereas here, you have not only an unspecified place, but unspecified persons and totally unspecified locations. And the particularity requirement, if you look at the text of the Fourth Amendment, at a minimum there's a requirement that a warrant be issued by a neutral and detached magistrate, that it be founded on probable cause, and that it be sufficiently particular. In that respect, it is important to keep in mind that the Fourth Amendment speaks of both probable cause and particularity. And one of the distinctions with the roving wiretap or other types of warrants that have been affirmed by the Supreme Court is the lack of any limitation in the NIT warrant. Whereas if you have a roving wiretap, there are limitations built in, as I said. And that distinction between the probable cause requirement and the particularity requirement is very important. Because if you were to think of a real-world example, imagine that police had solid information that everyone entering a particular 100,000-seat football stadium was going to receive illegal drugs when they came in. They might very well have probable cause to believe that any given person who entered the stadium has drugs, but there's a separate particularity requirement. And in my view, the separate nature of the particularity requirement is built in the notion that we want to limit the power of any one judicial officer to authorize intrusions on people. And that's essentially what the NIT warrant did here. There may have been probable cause to believe that each person who accessed Playpen was accessing child pornography or possessing child pornography. But the question is whether one judicial officer located in the Eastern District of Virginia can issue one warrant to authorize a search of all of those individuals. In this case, greater particularity was not only necessary, but it was feasible. The particularity requirement is context specific. In this case, the FBI had seized control of Playpen. As you can see from Special Agent McFarland's affidavit in support of the search warrant application, the FBI had a great deal of information about Playpen. It knew the particular subforums where the supposedly the worst of the worst was going on. It knew information about the top users or the most prevalent users of Playpen. So with that information, the FBI could have requested a more specific warrant from the magistrate judge in the Eastern District of Virginia. Instead, what the FBI did was seek unwarranted and unauthorized, unconstitutional discretion from the magistrate judge to be able to search all activating computers wherever located. And then the FBI special agent admitted in the affidavit that the FBI might execute the warrant more narrowly if it thinks it's appropriate. That's exactly backwards. The FBI had the information to be more particular. We mentioned the roving wiretap example, but just to emphasize the point that the NIT warrant is unprecedented in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, I know that the government cited the Caro case from the Supreme Court in its brief. Of course, Caro dealt with the issue of the beeper attached to an object and then location identifying information was transmitted back to law enforcement. There again, that's not an instance in which the warrant authorized intrusions in with respect to unknown persons and unknown places. The beeper was tied to a very specific place, the object that was going to be tracked.
Counsel, in view of this amendment to the rule, what's going to be prevented in the future if this decision is affirmed?
Well, of course, the FBI, law enforcement, judges would have to consider both the Fourth Amendment issue and the rule or statute-based issue presented by Rule 41B. And I think that goes back to what I was saying about how the FBI could have made the NIT warrant request more specific. As it is, even with the amendment to Rule 41B, the NIT warrant is still not particular enough. It still fails Fourth Amendment scrutiny at this point. Now, if the FBI were to more narrowly tailor a future NIT warrant, and then they have the benefit of the amendment to Rule 41B, then that's a type of warrant that could be valid. But again, there's two separate requirements here. The government has emphasized the importance of the Constitution over the rules and statutes, and of course courts going forward would have to consider both.
Mr. Hanson, could you give me an example of a more narrow tailoring of the warrant that you believe would meet constitutional muster?
Well, with the information that the FBI had at its disposal at the time that it sought the NIT warrant in the Eastern District of Virginia, it could have mentioned the usernames that it noticed were most persistent in posting activity on Playpen, who had logged in the most. I think that would help the particularity issue. Or again, because they'd identified specific sub-forums where the worst of the worst conduct was going on, it could have focused on the sub-forums as well, because that would be another layer of protection against an innocent computer logging on to Playpen. I know the government focuses on the fact that there are a number of affirmative steps that someone needed to take to get on to Playpen. That doesn't change the possibility that someone could have been using Playpen on a public computer or on a friend's computer, not on their own computer. So there is at least some risk of innocent people getting caught up in this. The Playpen warrant is different, again, than an all-persons warrant that has been affirmed by courts in the past. That's another type of warrant that is tied to a specific place and at least a specific smaller group of people, because you're not going to have thousands and thousands of people in one specific place that are subject to an all-persons warrant. So what I want to emphasize is the truly unprecedented nature of the NIT warrant when you're considering the Fourth Amendment particularity issue. And I think Judge Shepard made a great point with respect to the sophistication of the technology at issue and the fact that the magistrate judge, in essence, had to rely upon the averments of the FBI agent. Particularity is another protection against, if the magistrate got it wrong, if a warrant's not particular, if she relied upon information from the FBI, if a warrant's more particular, then there are fewer intrusions. You're not worried about thousands of people being subject to a search pursuant to an illegal warrant. So I think that's an important point.
Did you wish to reserve any time for?
No, that's fine, Your Honor. I would like to address briefly the good faith argument that's been discussed. The government has noted that because of the amendment to Rule 41B and the fact that under the rules and the Magistrates Act that a warrant like the NIT warrant would be valid today, of course, that doesn't address the Fourth Amendment issue with respect to good faith. And moreover, it's a fairly cribbed view of good faith. I don't think that courts are concerned about whether law enforcement is going to comply with any one given rule. The point's broader than that. We want FBI agents, we want law enforcement to carefully follow all of the rules, don't act and ask questions later, but instead to be better about following all the rules. And that was a failure of the FBI in this instance. I would reiterate the importance of Judge Gorsuch's concurrence in the Kruger case from the Tenth Circuit. It both stands for the proposition that if you have a warrant that's issued without authority, it's as if there's no warrant at all. But moreover, as to the prejudice point, under this circuit's case law, the issue is whether the search would have been conducted had the rule been followed. The Tenth Circuit, and this is more of the majority opinion, makes clear that the question is not some hypothetical one, because, of course, in this instance, there's no way to conclude that Bo Krogan or Stephen Horton's computers in the Southern District of Iowa would have been searched if the rules were followed. I see that I'm out of time. I'd ask you to affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson. Mr. Goodhand, your rebuttal.
Very briefly, Your Honor, focusing first on particularity, if there's anything that this litigation has shown, it's that the district courts are not in universal agreement about all of the issues in this case, with one exception, particularity. 22 defendants have raised a particularity argument. 22 district courts have rejected it. And that makes sense when you think about it. My opponent referred to unknown persons being subject to the warrant. That's not accurate to the extent that the warrant identified searches relating to people who logged into, with a username and a password, a site dedicated to pornography. And if I can just quote quickly from a district court decision below, this is from Broy, that the warrant encompassed a large number of possible computers potentially located in a large number of districts does not mean it suffered from a lack of particularity. It merely indicates the FBI suspected a large number of users would access the website from all over the country. There was rampant criminality relating to child pornography here. The warrant effectively and reasonably targeted those users in a very particularized fashion. As to good faith, I would note two things. Particularity, of course, is also subject to Leon good faith exception, number one. Number two, if this court affirms the district court order below, this court is essentially deterring conscientious police conduct. The FBI did everything that they should have done here. The magistrate did, too. We ask that you reverse the lower court below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodhand. Court wishes to thank counsel for all involved, for both the defendants and for the government, for your presence and the argument which you've provided the court. The briefing that you've submitted will take the case under advisement and render a decision as prompt as possible. Thank you.